Drinking and Alcoholics Anonymous. And to be involved in a conference like this is really special. And Jay alluded a little bit before that, you know, our speaker tonight is here. And I was all over the road trying to figure out how to introduce him because it's his birthday and I'm not supposed to say anything about that and this and that. And his son's here and that's a real treat to him. He's had a real surprise and I'm sure a real afternoon of a lot of surprises. But, you know, I knew of Sterling long before I knew Sterling. And he was an example of what this program can do in a man's life. And I know since I've gotten to know him that he has become an example to me of how this program works and how to work this program, and the good times as well as the bad times. I know all of you, you're personally have people in your areas where you're all from, Ohio, Virginia, North Carolina, who have people that are special. And Sterling, in my mind, has become an icon in South Carolina in Alcoholics Anonymous. And would you would help me please welcome Sterling Watts.
I'm Sterling Watts. I'm a happy alcoholic. Hi, everybody. It's a good thing I'm a hillbilly. I don't even know what an icon is. So it's not going to mess up my head any, I can tell you that. It has been a good day. And, you know, it's good to be here. It's an honor to ever be asked anywhere. If you get to ask back, that's something real special for a drunk like me. And it's real good to be back at Fellowship by the Sea. It's particularly good you know, I keep telling them I got this story of where I grew up in Detroit and rode a motorcycle, was in a gang till I was 30. And it's a good story, and I'm going to tell it, but every time I go somewhere, I see somebody from my home group or something. And we got a ton of them here from my home group, and so I'm happy to have them, and I'm extremely happy to have my son and his wife here because that's a very special surprise for me. You know, I feel like I'm qualified to be here because I'm a real alcoholic that's found a substitute for alcohol. And for that substitute to work, I had to do some things. You all told me I had to get a sponsor. I had to get a home group. I had to get into the steps and take the principles that I learned there out and put them in my life and work with them a day at a time. And because I did that, I found a relationship with the God as I understand Him that has helped me not to take a drink since September the 25th, 1973. Now, I'm very, very grateful for that. But I also want to tell you that while I was hunting for that substitute, I tried about everything else that was out there. And I'm real glad to tell you tonight that it hadn't been necessary for me to be analyzed, tranquilized, hypnotized, or baptized since then either. You know, I'm just fortunate. Alcoholics Anonymous has done the whole job for me. You know, we hear a lot today about problems other than alcohol. Well, I had problems other than alcohol before I ever knew alcohol existed. See, I'm a hillbilly, and I'm the only son of a hillbilly school teacher. I was born up in the Appalachian Mountains in the middle of the Depression, and they named me Sterling Fletcher Watts III. I don't think I had a chance from the very get-go. And an interesting thing is, I look back, I never had any identity. The first few years of my life, Mama was a hillbilly school teacher. I was Miss Kitty's little boy. And then I got married to a prominent farmer's daughter, and overnight I was Mac Jackson's son-in-law. And I came to South Carolina and had one son that was quite a football player, all-state in high school, played over at Clemson, and later signed with the pros. And when I got down there, I was Waldo's daddy, you know. And so when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I could stand up here and say I'm Sterling Watts, I thought I'd arrived. And now, you know, I tell you this, I don't know how you all got here. I understand over in West Virginia and around here at the beach and all, they just knocked on the door and said, I want to come in, get in the steps and get spiritual. I didn't come in here that way. I had a lot of help. A lot of help getting here. State troopers and judges and bosses. But mainly I had help from Al-Anon. In fact, I say I came into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when I became powerless over Al-Anon. And You see, my wife got into Al-Anon about 6 months before I got into Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you remember the first night they thought you'd been sober long enough to take part in a program? Well, they'd asked me to read how it works, and I really felt good, and I'd practiced and wasn't going to miss a word. And the chairman said, "And to read how it works," and he forgot my name and said, "Nancy's husband." So... And so, you see, and a guy with an ego like mine needs that. And today when I'm sitting around on the tables and I get to think maybe I know who I am or I am somebody, there's always somebody like Al or Mike or Ray or somebody will call on old What's-His-Face, and I need that. I need that reminder now. You know, my sponsor and I, when I did my four-step, we kind of came to a conclusion that I was just a weird kid that grew up in a normal home. And I accepted that. I accepted that. But then, you know, they study alcoholics a lot. We're the most studied species other than white rats, I think, if there is. And they came up with this thing about a dysfunctional family. Well, now, it sounded better if I was from a dysfunctional family. Maybe I wasn't a weird kid. And so I went to my sponsor and I said, "Hey, do you think it's possible that I grew up in a dysfunctional home?" He said, "I don't think there's any question. You were there, weren't you?" So... Now, and you know, I look back and every school class I was in or church or army unit or anything else was dysfunctional, so it might have had me something to do with me. Now, you know, when I think when I started talking, I started lying. And I was a good liar and I loved to lie. But I was a little bit different kind of liar than most people. See, I just didn't tell you a lie and leave. I hung around and kept on till I made sure you believed that lie, you know. And for instance, to show you how bad a liar I was, when I was about so high, we had to memorize Bible verses and recite them before we ate any meals on Sunday. I was capable of memorizing Bible verses, but I took a lot of pleasure in making them up. And one of the verses I made up was, "If a man goeth on a long journey and returneth not, he stayeth a long while." Now, you know, it's bad enough to be making up the Bible verses, but what I liked was seeing the old folks running through that Bible. Trying to... Now, that just made me warm all over, I can tell you that. Now, in this home that I was raised in, there was four of us. There was a mother and a father and a sister. Now, this sister was 5 years older than I. And she was the second perfect person to ever walk the face of the earth. She never told a lie. She never did anything wrong. She never came home late. She made straight A's all the way through school, valedictorian in high school, and dean's list in college. She had absolutely cornered the market on being good. And I could realize if I was going to get any attention, I had to be good at being bad. And I think that's what came about. And, you know, my first recollection, and, you know, as I've learned a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, but one of the things that I've learned, and I'll tell you this right now, how I perceive things were not necessarily how they were. And what you said, I didn't necessarily hear. I had kind of selective hearing, so... When I tell you my story, you're just going to see life as I perceived it, and that was what was controlling my actions. So, but as the first thing that I remember ever hearing that lasted with me was, "Why can't you be like Elizabeth?" And that was constant, ringing in my ears. I always felt like I was less than, and I just accepted that, and I started through life that way. Drinking as a teenager was not much problem for me because everybody in the mountains knew me, and I'm sure I tasted it, but I just didn't have an opportunity to drink. Well, shortly after graduating from high school, I had to go 55 miles away from home down to Roanoke, Virginia, to be inducted into service. And that was the first time I'd ever been that far away from home without adult supervision. And that night I got drunk and I got sick and I almost died. Now, that was in September of 46. 27 years later, three states away, in September of 73, I'm still drinking, still getting drunk, and still almost dying. So there's a certain amount of insanity that has to go with our disease for a man to go through what I went through, and I know today it was just a drink. I changed jobs. I changed everything about my life. I kept doing different things, and I always protected my right to drink. Now, I had a couple of things wrong with me. You know, I was a sick drunk, and a sick drunk's not popular. You all know that. You don't invite him over to your house to look at your new house or your new rug or anything like that. I can remember back in night. I had a good buddy that I drank with all the time. Back in 1956, he bought his wife the prettiest new 56 Pontiac I've ever seen. It was black and silver. And we're out one day drinking, been riding around all Saturday drinking, and I began to get sick, and I started rolling the window down. And he threw the brakes on. He said, "Not in this car, you don't get out." And I got out and put my hands on top of the car and spit up right back in his car. So you see, getting sick was not popular at all. When I first started telling my story, my wife said, "Look, do you have to tell all those old sick stories? I've cleaned enough of that stuff up. I don't want to be messing with it anymore." And it's necessary for me to remember how sick I was, because I don't want to go back there. So I developed a word that she would accept, and I say I unswallowed a lot. So that sounds simple enough, doesn't it? I did a lot of this unswallowing, and I had sore eyeballs. I had the sorest eyeballs of any mortal you ever saw. I can remember coming off of a drunk, and I'd be laying on my back, and the fly would go by, and I'd move my... It hurt me all the way to my hip pocket, I'm telling you. Now, I had to look about these things, and Daddy had an ulcer, and I had a couple of uncles with a nervous stomach. So I just assumed that I'd inherited all this sickness from Daddy's side of the family. Being that unlucky, Miss Kitty had slightly protruding eyeballs. I just assumed these sore eyeballs came from Mama's side of the family. And I started having blackouts when I was 17 and 18 years old. And I remember those blackouts very vividly because they were the first ones I had. Now, the blackouts followed me right till I got here. But those first ones I remember real well. And I just assumed that nobody ever explained it to me. And I just assumed if you drank the way I drank, that you probably had these sore eyeballs too. I didn't know it. And these blackouts. So I came home armed with all that information and started out on what was a normal drinking career for me. Now, I don't know what normal is at all, but if I ever had one, it was from like 48 to 62. I got back home. I married immediately. I married my childhood sweetheart. I got a job on the ground floor in the textile industry. A year later, my son came along. Three or four years later, we built a house like in 1954. A bunch of husbands bought a land out in the woods and started building houses like everybody was doing after World War II. And if you looked at me, as I saw things, I got a lot of promotions and never lost any work because I drank. But when I stop and look back on that, I was in that, during that period of time, I was in five or six automobiles that were totally lost. Sometimes I was driving, sometimes I was riding. Majority of the time, we had no idea who was driving and who was riding. One Thanksgiving day during this period of time, I had three accidents in the same day. And that day, I hit the same man twice. Now, I just didn't hit him again in that same parking lot. I got him 15 miles away in the afternoon from where I'd hit him that morning, you know. And in those days, all you did was report these things to your insurance agent. So I remember calling that second accident in, and he said, "Watts, how drunk are you? You reported that accident this morning." I said, "Man, I'm not drunk. I've hit him again, you know." Give me a break, you know. Well, now, I'm not a handyman. I don't know screwdriver from a pair of pliers or a saw. I don't know anything about gardening. I'm not a gardener. I just never did anything that got you any points with the lady folks. I like to lay around on the creek bank drunk and shoot pool and play cards and that kind of thing. And right after we got married, it seemed like to me that if I moved into your area tomorrow, I'd look out the window and there'd be a sign, Yard of the Month, in my neighbor's yard. And all I ever got was like wild onion of a decade, you know. So, and I'd be right in the middle of a ton of handymen that could fix anything. And so it started out right away, why can't you be like Al? Why can't you be like Tom? But see, I'd already been to boot camp on that. I got used to why can't you be back like Elizabeth way back there. So this didn't bother me being less than all these handymen and gardeners. So I told you we bought that piece of land in 1954 to build these houses, and we're all going to be turnkey houses. We're supposed to just move into them, but these handymen took over. And they started building porches and putting roofs on, and some of them put in the furnace and the cabinets. You know how y'all do. And that's when I really first felt impending doom. She's looking at me like, when are you going to do something, you know? Numb stuff. And so I got a brilliant notice one day. I looked around and not a soul on that street put his mailbox in. Now, you know, by this time, I don't know whether any of y'all did this or not, but I used liquor for a lot of things. But one of the things I used it for was in any type of a task I didn't want to do, I had mentally signed a certain amount of liquor to that. If I was going to mow the yard, if it was a pint or a couple of cases of beer, according to how hot it was. Bar money took a fifth. Trade cars took a fifth. I had my sister. I didn't like to get along with my sister. I called her my two-pint sister when she was coming to visit. So I never had put a mailbox in. I don't know how much liquor I signed to it, but I think it's kind of alcoholic how this thing went down. I went down and got the head engineer to help me, and we took a 8-foot pipe and spot welded another pipe down inside of it and brought it back home, and I went down to Sears and got the biggest mailbox I had and put Sterling Fletcher Watts III on it and just let it flow. Nice big letters. Put that sucker down in 4 feet of steel reinforced concrete, and I tamped her well. And I went to bed, and you know, you alcoholics know how it is. Just before you worked hard all day and drank, and you just easing off into that slumber only we know about. I can almost feel it now. I thought, gosh, she's going to be proud of me. And the next morning, my phone rang as my neighbor. He said, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "Why?" He said, "You got that mailbox in facing your house now." And I had about an hour to get it dug up and turned around. It looked like I'd built a small swimming pool and just filled it in, you know. Now, by this time, see, I was a tavern drinker. Oh, man, I loved the beautiful places, Waldo Doug Dobbins. I loved a lot of these places. I loved the dark lights and the beautiful ladies that were there to listen to your troubles and to listen to that good hillbilly tear-jerking music and the shuffleboard. Oh, I just loved it. I loved it all. And my wife hated everything it was about drinking. She hated the whole scene. Now, I'd stop in from work. I'd work hard, and I'd stop in from work just to have a couple of beers. I worked hard, and I knew that I had a little son at home, and I loved him, and I had a wife home, and I loved him, and I only meant to be there for two beers. And they'd throw me out when 11 o'clock came, they quit selling beer. And I lost all time when I got into the drinking scene. I lost all account of time. Now, she hated everything about the drinking scene. I've had her say things like, "You almost stopped and got a beer," you know. She could tell when I was thinking about it. And we had developed a thing that I call a muscular chemical reaction. Every time I bent a muscle to take a chemical, her mouth flew open. And I call that chin music. And that's the chinniest woman you ever saw in your life. Now, here's this marriage, and everything I like, she hates. So the marriage is not getting along too good. And I have worked my way up in the plant where I'm buying a lot of chemicals and a lot of machinery, and a lot of salesmen are calling on me regularly, and they drank just the way I did. But the good part about this thing was that they left home on Monday and didn't go home till Friday. And that way they could drink all week and not have chin music. So I gave up one of the very best jobs I ever had and came to South Carolina to sell chemicals. Truthfully, I know today as I look back, I came down there to drink and have a good time. And I did. I did both. I'll never forget it. I went to work for one man owned this company out of Rhode Island. And he said, "My company's name is not well known in the South." I'm going to give you a new automobile and an unlimited expense account, and I want you to get my name spread around down there. Well, I'm sure he meant where he had chemicals to sell, but I got in a few jailers and bailiffs and state troopers. A lot of people knew his name by the time I was through with him. And it was an interesting thing. Up in Virginia, you could only haul a small amount of liquor for however many people you had in the car. There's no restrictions in South Carolina. All you could buy, and I just packed the trunk of that car full of liquor, and I ran up and down the road to all the dyeing and finishing plants selling chemicals, and I had something real good. If I could keep my alcohol level just right, I could go a long time and not sleep, and they loved that. I could play golf all day and deal cards all night, take a shower, and start right over again. I could go this way 2 or 3 days, and they'd say things like, "Why, I'd rather ride with Watson, him drunk, and I had Tom and him sober, and I'd just drink a pint and take them anywhere they wanted to go." I loved that, you know. And we didn't have many bottles. We didn't have any bars. So I'd just drive into the parking lot and raise a truck. We'd have a few drinks, or we'd go around to the spring and have a few drinks. I had a guy down to Abbeville said, "You called down here 19 months, and we weren't sure what you were selling." Said, we thought you might be a liquor salesman in the wrong place, you know. Well, along about this time, I tell you, when I got here, I weighed about 289 pounds the last time I weighed. So I'm getting close to 300, and I'm full of all that fluid and puffed up. You know how we look, and I don't know. I know I just didn't get that way overnight. And my company had been wanting me to take an insurance exam, and I wouldn't go. And I think I was probably afraid of what I was going to find out. I don't know why, but finally it was either get fired or take this exam, and I went in. And I'll never forget the lady, the nurse, took my blood pressure and left. And I started rolling my sleeve down, going to leave. And here she came in here with this card. I said, "Well, what is that?" She said, "That's oxygen." I said, "What's it for?" She said, "Well, your blood pressure is so high that you're in stroke zone." I said, "Now, wait a minute. I just came in here feeling good off the street for an insurance exam. And if my blood pressure is that high, I ought to have some symptoms." She said, "Well, usually you're dizzy." Well, now, I'd been dizzy for over a year. I'd been dizzy. And I had this back way of getting home, and there was a bridge there. And when I'd get there and there was three bridges, I couldn't cross them. And I'd take a little nap, and I could get it down to two, and I could get across, you know. And I was kind of thinking I had a brain tumor or something, you know. And to show you how sick I was, I came home tickled to death. Drank about a half a pint and told Nancy, I said, "Man, there's nothing in the world wrong with me but a little blood pressure problem, you know." Well, by this time, the actions are getting bad. And so she started going, she met some people and started taking me to AA. Now, I don't know exactly where we went. Sometimes I think we might have gone to the Automobile Association because she's sick as I was. I'm sure you know. But anyhow, and one day she met an old guy there, and his name was Squire. And he was been sober for years, and she really liked him. And so the chin music got unbearable one day, and I said, "Well, I'll just call Squire, and we'll talk AA." And she just beamed right up, and I dialed Squire and told him I was ready to talk. And he got in his car and came across town. I got in my car and left town. Well, and he got over, and evidently he kind of 12-stepped her. He told her part of his story, and she told him part of mine. She told him about how bad I was shaking, I'm sure. And now this time I was shaking. I could thread a sewing machine it running wide open, you know. And all that came out of this call was that if I'd take a lot of honey and orange juice or honey and Cairo syrup, I'd be all right. So a ritual was I'd stop and drink about a half a pint and come home, and she'd be standing there, and she'd shove 3 tablespoons full of this Cairo syrup down my throat and hand me this concoction of half orange juice and honey, and I'd drink it down and head down there to where I had my vodka hid, and when I got there, I'd be so thick together I couldn't hardly get it in my mouth. Now, It didn't take us long to realize AA wasn't doing me any good. It was just making me the sweetest drunk in the Southeast. The fruit flies were following me, I'll tell you. Well, That didn't slow her down a bit. She found a guy who had tried AA, had a job just like mine, and AA hadn't worked for him, and he'd gone to a psychiatrist, and he'd gotten all well. So off I went to psychiatrist, and that's another three-hour story. I had enough Miss Kitty stuff, I could still be laying on that couch if it had been comfortable. But anyway, he said an interesting thing. He could see I was still getting drunk, but they never mentioned drunk or drinking. He said a thing. He said, the next time he acts up, I'm going to put him where I can observe him more closely. Well, now, we didn't have any place in Greenville at the time. No detox. We had no treatment center. And the only place they had to put a drunk was a hospital for the emotionally disturbed. Ours was Marshall Pickens. Now, I tell you, I went out there four or five times. I don't know how many times. I've been out there in the trunk of the car. I've been out there in the back of a pickup. I've been in an ambulance. Every time I went, I was dog drunk. And if you look at my record, all you see is schizophrenia, hypertension, paranoia. You know, they never put down drunk. And the only reason I can figure at those prices, they were scared to. They just didn't think it looked right. Well, I remember the first time I was over there. I'm a kind of drunk, give me about 5 days and let me rest up, and I'd just come to. And I came to, and I was in occupational therapy. And I'm making ceramic ashtrays, leather watch bands. I never saw such pretty work in all my life. And I was particularly good at these leather watch bands. And they were nice watch bands, too. I could make three of them in 1 hour. And the next best person, it took him 3 hours to make one. I was popping out those watch bands. If they hadn't run out of leather, I'd still be over there. I can tell you that. Now, the interesting thing about all this and the sad part about all this, nobody is addressing my drinking. Nobody is talking about my drinking. I'm hearing nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous or any recovery whatsoever. Now, this was a very interesting place and an interesting way they treated us drunks. They called us clients, and they gave you groups of about 20, and I was in my group of about 20. There was 19 women in there and me. And most of these ladies, this was back in the time when they gave a lot of shock treatment. And these ladies, most of them are taking shock treatment, and to say the least, they were somewhat nervous. And so if you'd been real good all during the week, you got a reward on Saturday. You got the peanut butter sandwich, and you got to hike over to Kmart. Well, we gathered back in the lobby, and he said, now, all these ladies, most of them smoke, but said they can't be trusted with matches. And I got the matches, and I had my little troops, and we went out. I never been so proud. We went out. If they want to smoke, they had to see me, and I really felt like they finally saw my leadership capabilities, you know. I really felt like I was an officer's candidate school, you know. And you know, to show you how sick I was, it was about a year later when I really looked back and what had happened. I'm 44 years old, and I'd worked my way up to the keeper of the matches in a nut house. It just... Well... I got out of there and came home, and we could tell this wasn't doing a whole lot for my recovery, you know. And she said, well, you haven't tried to be rehabilitated. Well, we didn't want to miss anything. So off I came down here to Florence to the Palmetto Center. And, you know, that's a state-run place, and I got the biggest resentment I ever had in my life. At that time, I didn't know what a resentment was, but I got real mad. You see, everybody down there was a ward of the state. Nobody's paying anything because they don't have a job. We had a doctor. He just locked up his practice, came down there, no job. They paid for it. He's in there free. Well, I had a job but no insurance. Just going to cost me $600 for what everybody else is getting free. Now, I'll come back to this. I'll come back to this because I think that $600 is where God started working in my life about my drinking and maybe getting serious about it a little later on. They said that they didn't sponsor AA at all, but that AA was allowed to come in on Thursday night, and if I was interested, I could go listen to them. They have a speaker there. Well, I went over. I don't know why, maybe just... But anyway, I went. And to show you how sick I was, this is what I thought y'all was sickest bunch of people I'd ever seen in my life. They drove 45, 50 miles down there to tell me their trouble. And I'm paying $600 because I'm so sick. And let me, what made me think this, they had a boy there that looked like he was about 25 years old. And he said he couldn't take one drink without getting drunk. Well, I never thought, can you imagine one drink drunk? It just... Now that, I could relate that that was serious, you know. And I felt like with all my drinking experience, I took his name. And when I got out of there, I was reasonably sure that I could keep him going for 3 or 4 weeks if I could keep him buying. I knew that. Well, now, when I left there, they said an interesting thing. They said, go back to Greenville, don't drink, we'll think you'll be all right. Well, I was beginning to suspect this myself, you know, but on my way back to Greenville, this was my thinking. I'm going to do that. I'm going back to Greenville, and I'm not going to drink, and I'm going to show them it won't work for me, and I'll sue them and get my $600 back. You know? So I went back to Greenville, and I didn't drink for several months. I'm not exactly sure, maybe five or six, and the most miserable time I ever spent. I'm living proof tonight for a real alcoholic, just to take the alcoholic away from him and put nothing else in. No God, no program, no nothing. Just take alcohol away is miserable. I hated everybody and everything. I got a glass about this big, and I filled it full of iced tea, and everywhere I went, I said, look at me. I'm 44 years old. Never drink again. I said, let's drink, get our milk and cookies and go to bed. You know, I thought my manhood was gone because I couldn't drink. And I hated everybody. I hated you if you could drink and not get in trouble. No chin music, no state troopers, nothing. I hated you. If you could not drink and have fun, I hated you. So I just was full of hate. I hated everybody. And had I not gotten drunk, I'd have committed suicide. I did get drunk, and I drank for a period of 5 or 6 months, and this is the period when I say I drank zombolically. I was just a zombie. I didn't know whether I was going or coming. In my job, you call and you schedule appointments, and I'd call and say, could I come over tomorrow for lunch? They'd say, well, fool, you were over here yesterday, you know. Or they'd call and say, this is Tom, where's my sample? I had no idea who Tom was or who I'd promised a sample to, you know. And it was kind of sad. I'd kind of come to when I got a hold of the steering wheel. And if I looked down and I'm clean like I am tonight, I knew I was going out. I didn't know where. And I'd back out and go around the corner and check in the Econo Lodge. Just long enough to take a few drinks, get things organized, find out where I am, and you know the deal from there on in. Or I'd come to and I'd look down and I'd been sick all over myself. I knew I was coming home. I didn't know where I'd been. And it was just that kind of rat race. And sometime in September, I came back from Augusta, Georgia, and I think I came back to die. I went back in what Nancy referred to as my rat hole, and I don't know how long I stayed back there. But I was back there quite a while, and I never want to forget when I came to. I was in, or whatever I did, I was in that, been in that drunken lair that only just old lair that we lay in, the filth and the odor and the stench of a drunk place, and I had to crawl to the bathroom. My legs were too rubbery for me to walk. But the main thing that happened was when I took a drink or could get one down, it did nothing for me. Liquor had quit working, and I didn't know what to do. And for a drunk like me, that's pretty tough when liquor quits doing the job. And I just dropped my head over my hands, and I said something like, my God, nobody knows. And she was there and said, I think AA does. She got me dressed, and we went to an AA meeting that night. And I don't remember a lot about that meeting. I do think that's the first time I got a little bit honest about my drinking, because on the way home, she said, you didn't pick up a chip. Now, she knew about the chips. You see, I told you back there, I went to some AA meetings, and whoever took me, they were nice to me. They gave me coffee and cookies and cake and donuts. And so when they gave out the chips, they'd hit me, and I'd jump up and get one. If they'd hit me 6 times, I'd have gone right through the birthday chip, you know. Because I wasn't serious about any of it. But that night, I was serious. And I said, no, if I don't get a drink down tonight, I'll die. And sometime that night, I did get a drink down. And that was on September the 23rd. And this is important to me, because when I look back, there's altogether evidence that I haven't had another drink since the 23rd. And I was too sick to think about this myself. I think this is a God thing. I wait 2 days. I had enough sense to do that. I think God knew me well enough to know that my makeup was that if I was in here and had the least bit of thought in the back of my mind a year or so into sobriety, that I had you all fooled and I'd lost respect for you. And I probably would have never made it. So, but I want to tell you that since that day in September in 73, my life has made a 180-degree change. I didn't know that it was possible for a man to live and be as happy, joyous, and free as I am right now. Now, I used to think you got out of jail, I was free. I realized I was just loose, you know. But the thing that creates this freedom is I don't know of one thing about me to this night as I stand here that I haven't talked over with another alcoholic to God as I understand it. My book, my life is an open book. I used to be worried when the telephone would ring, try to get there. I'd try to say I'm not here. I don't care. Now, if I hear my name mentioned over in the corner, I like to know what they're talking about because if it's something I might need to make an amends for. And I like to keep my life an open book and keep it caught up to date. And it's a great way to live. Now, I know that my sobriety is a gift. I believe my sobriety is a gift from God as I understand it. And I believe that because drunks are going to die all over this world tonight as I stand here. They're going to die right here in the beach tonight in Greenville where I come from. And I have no idea why I got this gift. But I do believe this, that there's a lot of responsibility comes with it. I think that I have the responsibility to be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when a drunk walks in that door like I did. And I have the responsibility to take him by the hand and pass this program along to him just like it came out of the first 164 pages in this book. I don't believe that I have the right to add on to it or delete from it. I don't think it needs any changes. But I think we do have a tremendous amount of responsibility, not only to the alcoholic that comes in, but to the community that we serve. I think we have an opportunity to show in our community, in our daily living, the practices of these principles in all our affairs of what a great program and what a great change Alcoholics Anonymous can make in our lives. Now, I'm also living proof that you don't have to do everything just exactly right from the day you got here. I did a lot of things wrong. For instance, they said you got to get a sponsor. Well, now, there's an old man there that was a rough, tough CB. He drank the way I did. I'd talk to him. He said he'd been sober 29 years. Well, I knew that nobody drank the way I did, had been sober for 29 years. And I felt like if he could make you all believe that lie, I wanted what he had. I had a lot of respect for him. Now, this old man couldn't drive at night, and I'd drive him out to speak. And I was very keen. I'd watch who picked up a desire chip or a 30-day chip or a 9-month chip, and when the meeting was over, I'd go up and put my arm around him. I'd say, man, this thing's powerful. You keep on coming back. Between me and that speaker, we got almost 30 years in this thing, you know. Now, they had a thing back when I got here. They'd say, has anybody got anything bothering their sobriety they want to talk about? I hope you don't do that in your group now. If you do, I hope you don't have somebody like me in there. See, I had noticed that the tougher and the worst thing that was going on in your life, the more love you got. And, you know, a guy could say my house burned down, I wrecked both cars, and my mom-in-law's come to live with me. And they'd just, after the meeting, they'd just love him and tell him, here, call me. And another old boy would come in and say, boy, I just got a big raise, won the lottery, and we're going to Honolulu, and we'll buy my wife a Mercedes. Say, watch him. He may get drunk, you know. So with my keen intellect, when they did that, I had some of the most God-awful stories you ever heard in your life. Now, won't any of them true, but y'all spent a whole hour sometimes talking about them, and sometimes I told you I loved to do this line. I was out in the yard line one night, and I had a group there, and I really had them, you can tell when you got them charmed, you know. and I'm laying it on him, and my sponsor pecked on my shoulder. He said, "Boy, are you praying the way I told you to?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You're a damn liar." Well, now, he not only broke up my charm group, but he insulted me. And I jumped in the car. I don't even think I stayed for the meeting. And the first AA prayer that I ever had that I know of that I was serious about, I prayed that old man get drunk and I'd give him his chip. Now, I also did some things right from the very start. You said get a home group, and I got a home group, and I think that's one of the most important things we can do, other than taking a drink and getting a sponsor. You see, if you go to that group on a regular basis, they're going to find out about you. They're going to know what you're thinking, and that just may save your life. It did mine. I also believe if you go to AA meetings on a regular basis and get that home group, no matter what your attitude is, life will change. You can have a bad attitude and just keep going to AA meetings and listening long enough, and your life will begin to change. Strange things will begin to happen to you. And, you know, I was in that group, and we had an old gal in that group named Taylor, and she'd been sober longer than dirt, and she knew everything there was to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. She knew the answers to questions I didn't even have any intentions of asking her, you know. And she'd say, "Take my name, son, and give me a call before you take a drink." I said, "You gave me that number Tuesday. Well, take it again. You may have lost it, you know." And so one day I'd been out on the road, and things were tough. And I called home, and Nancy's mad at me, and things are just bad. And I stopped out on the rest area, and I called Taylor, and I said, told her who I was, and I said, "Old woman, you said to call you, and I got 7 liquor stores passed before I get home, and I can't get by without stopping and getting me something to drink. Now, you said to call you. What you want me to do?" She said, "Go out in the median and strip off naked and stand there till they take you to jail." Now, and I hung up that phone. I said, "That dang old woman's crazy." I passed every one of those liquor stores. Now, what she'd done, she'd insulted my intelligence, but what she'd done was stole my slip. See, I was a slip planner, and a lot of other things stole my slip. Well, there was a time when I was sitting back in the back of the room, and I looked around, and y'all were serious about this thing. It was working for you. Wasn't going to work for me. I was different. But you'd been good to me. Sincere people. And I said, "Well, I'm gonna show them I really respect what they did for me. I'm going to do everything that they tell me to do, exactly when they tell me to do it. I'm going to prove to them it won't work for me." If you're here tonight, you're new or been around a little while, and you've tried everything else, pretty simple. Just try that. Just try doing what they tell you when they tell you to do it. Show them it won't work. Now, one of the things that when I started on this crusade, I heard you said, "Listen." Well, I hadn't listened since I got here. I came in the door talking, see, so I started listening. Now, people would say how they were somewhere and strange things happened. And again, I contend if you go to AA meetings on a regular basis, strange things will begin to happen in your life. And when they'd relate these things, they would say, "Gosh, isn't that great how God's working in your life? How good is He to you?" Now, I'll tell you what happened. I went to a meeting I had never been to, didn't mean to go to, just walked in the house one night and I said, "I think I'll go over to this meeting in Greer." I went over to that meeting. I told you I was a slip planner, and I was on one of my slip planning things here. I had to have my car serviced, and they sold cold beer right around the corner from Sears. I was going to go down and have my car serviced, and while they were serviced, I was going to drink some cold beer the next day. So I sat there right on the front row, and I had that mug up on my head with the all that frost running down it. I didn't hear a thing the speaker said. And when the meeting was over, I tried to leave right quick, and I ran into this guy in the parking lot named Charlie Brown from Chattanooga, Tennessee, who was a salesman. And he was visiting in town. We talked a while, and I couldn't get rid of him. And then I went on home. Got up the next morning, went down to Sears. They took my car and the keys, and I turned to go to the beer joint, and there stood Charlie Brown. And he started talking to me, and he just talked and talked, and the next thing I knew, they pecked me on the shoulder and said, "Your car's ready." He said, "How about taking me out to Alano Club and get a cup of coffee?" And that was very... You know, I thought there were millions of you all. I'd be out of town. I'd be out of town. I was over in Newberry one night, way away from home, and I started in a country honky-tonk. And if y'all ever remember old Frank Stewart, Frank Stewart's there as a deputy sheriff. He said, "Boy, where are you going?" I called Jim Milton, and I thought, "My gosh, you can't get 50 miles away from home there watching you, you know." Well, anyway, I'm in this meeting, and I tell them about this strange thing that happened to me with Charlie Brown and how eerie it was. And they say, "Gosh, isn't that great how God's working in your life? Isn't God good to you?" And that's when they first dawned on me that God was working in my life. It'd been a while since I'd wanted a drink, and I didn't think I had anything spiritually going on because, you know. But so you see what you do, and you know you do it. You shared your God with me till I could become teachable and get a God of my own. And for that, I'll be very, ever, ever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for y'all for doing that for me. Now, there came a time when my sponsor got me, and I got serious. He took me by the hand. He led me through the steps, and I learned a lot in the steps. I learned a lot about love and trust and kindness. But the main thing I learned was about me. I didn't know about me. I didn't know what my capabilities were, what my lobby. I just didn't know what my talents were. I didn't know anything. I thought I had to be the very best at everything I did, or I wouldn't even try. I found out that all I have to do, even though I'm not a very talented man, is do the very best today with what God gave me to do with, and I'm going to be all right. And I do that, and you all accept me. I got a ton of friends. I still ain't a handyman or a gardener, but I love these handymen today, I can tell you that. But no, so all I have to do, and that's a good way to live. That's a good way to live, just to be me, and you all accept me that way. No more people pleasing, no more changing, just be me. Now, I've had more trauma probably since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever had when I was drinking. But I guess this is only natural. You know, I've been sober about six or seven years. And I realized I didn't have exactly what everybody else had. I saw some people that just radiated serenity. And I didn't seem to have that inner calmness. And I went to my sponsor and asked him about it, what he thought I ought to do. He says, "Well, why don't you get back in the book and see if you may have missed something?" So I got back in the book. Now, by the time I did this, I had been to 3 or 4 Charlie and Joe tapes. I had listened to, been in step studies several times, been through the book on numerous occasions, but I'd never been back into it just to use it as a textbook to find something in there that I needed to fix the particular situation I was in at this time. And I found so many things that were comforting to me and enlightening to me. And they're too numerous to go into, but real interesting, right at the end of chapter 4, where it says that if we drew near to him, he would disclose himself to us. He would disclose himself to me. And that made a lot of sense. And then I'd begin to think, well, where do I feel close to God? I feel close to God in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do. And, you know, it was interesting about, it sounded like then that all I had to do was get close to him, but 4 or 5 pages over, they didn't leave me any. They say there that he would provide everything I needed, provided I performed his work well. And that doesn't leave me out. That leaves me a lot of work that needs to be performing. So I set out about performing that work, and that seems to have kept me pretty close to a God as I understand it. You know, we overlook something. I think we go a little bit too fast. Right before how it works, it says a real interesting thing. It says alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and without help, it is too much for us. Now, that's not just when we get here. That's not the first day, I realize. I'm going to need help with this alcoholism the rest of my life. That's probably why I'm here tonight. I need help. I'm always going to need help with my alcoholism. And when the 11th step, I love the 11th step because the 11th step tells me exactly what to pray for. Exactly, for knowledge of His will. But then it says another thing. It indicates that once I know what His will is, I'm not going to have the power. I'm not going to want to do it, and I'm going to have to pray for the power to carry that out. So everywhere I go, I'm going to need power. And where am I going to find this power? We'll find this power right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I found it. Now, I'm the kind of alcoholic that couldn't endure death at all. Anytime anybody got dead, anytime anybody died, I didn't know what to do. I just got drunk. My mother died, I got drunk. My daddy died, I got drunk. I just made an ass out of myself. And I'd been sober about a little over 9 years. And my wife of 35 years, my Al-Anon of 9 years, died very suddenly. 3 months later, my sponsor died, and shortly after that, my sister died. And I'd have never gotten through any of that if I hadn't been able to come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and tap onto this power that you find here. The old-timers had showed me. They didn't tell me. It wasn't discussed. But I saw what they did. When trauma came in their life, they tripled up on their involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did what they had shown me to do. And I was lonely after my wife died, and then by going to Alcoholics Anonymous, I met Donna. A lot of you know Donna. In fact, I'm substituting for Donna tonight. And Donna and I met, and we were married, and we were married about 19 years. And this may be a little tough for me right now, but I lost Donna back in May. She was my best buddy. And I missed her dearly, but I have never been more grateful to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous as I was then. I've never seen such an outpouring of love and of prayers and all of these things that combine to give me the power to get through this. And I always look for something positive. And I've kind of inventoried this as you all have told me to. And I've learned some good things. Some real good things came out of this. I'd just like to pass it on to you. You see, when my first wife died, I had grief. But I had grief with some regret, with some guilt. There were some things I could never verbally really make amends to her for. There were some things that I had done during our married life, even after I got sober with finances and things. I hadn't been extremely honest in all occasions, and these weren't things that I could make amends for. There were some things I wish I had done. There were some things I wish I hadn't done. So I had grief with guilt. You all gave me the power to get through that. This time I have grief, but with no guilt. Because of your instruction, had a marriage, an AA marriage, where every morning we took time out to read, meditate, and talk over the problems of the day. We brought up anything that might be bothering us. We hid nothing. We hid nothing. And so today I know I don't have if I had, if I could, if I would, and grief. I'd just like to suggest to you that if you have a lasting relationship or you have a relationship now, do the very best you can to keep it very honest and open and on a day-to-day basis. It's not only a good way to live, it's a good way if something happens that you won't feel a bit guilty about. So God, again, has been very good to this old alcoholic. And I, again, want to thank all of you for your many prayers, your letters, and everything. It certainly helped me get through this trying time. It's even nice to come down here now and see so many friends and to be able to spend this weekend with so many of you and to know that I'm loved and that you all are feeling for me and have been praying for me. And I'm sure it's going to be a great weekend. Now, I've got some blessings. I've got two grandchildren that are grown, and they've never seen their grandfather take a drink. And if I never get another reward out of life, that's a reward in itself. I remember one time my little granddaughter said, "Well, Papa, I can't believe you were ever in jail," you know, and that. Now, that little granddaughter asked me if I'd come over to her school and talk on alcoholism. And that made me feel so very good. And I went over to the school, and I'm standing out there in the lobby. And this little gray-headed principal came up, and she looked me right in the eye, and she said, "Are you Allison's grandfather?" Now, I don't think I'll ever find out who I am. But the clincher is tonight, I know what I am. I'm an alcoholic that found a substitute for alcohol. That's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. Thank you.